Last year, a ragtag band of Christian geek podcasters joined together, taking on a shared theme to be discussed on their respective shows. This year, like any good sequel, and any bad sequel really, they're going bigger. They aren't just sharing a theme, they're sharing themselves. In the grand tradition of the Avengers movies, or Aliens vs. Predator, or Mario and Sonic the Hedgehog, King Kong vs. Godzilla, Archie meets the Punisher, it's not just a thematic event, it's a crossover. The Christian Geek podcasting community begins the year 2014 by trading hosts. Listen to your favorite podcasting hosts as they mix it up on other podcasts, and meet new podcasters on your favorite podcasts. Featuring these podcasts: Geekly Oaked, The Sci-Fi Show, Untold Podcast, The Sci-Fi Christian, Real World Theology, The Story Men, Geek This Podcast, Voices in My Head, Are You Just Watching, and Strangers and Aliens. The Christian Geek Podcast Crossover. It's the Secret Wars 2 of podcasting. Only, you know, good.
Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. All right, so everyone's coming through, so that's amazing. It helps when I open all the programs that I'm supposed to.
Never hurts.
All right, and so everything is...
Isn't it always human error?
Yeah, it is. It's never a computer's problem. It only does what you tell it to. Unless, of course, you watch her. And then
that's my experience of them. They do exactly what... I'm a software engineer by trade, and they do exactly what you tell them. Unfortunately, if you tell them to do stupid things, they'll do it really, really well.
Yes.
Actually, I watched her last night.
Oh, did you?
It was really good.
I really want to see it. Awesome.
Okay.
So you'd recommend that one?
Oh yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was done really well. It probably wasn't my favorite movie of the year, but it looks at things and we're going to discuss this on the two podcasts from now, I think.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
So okay. I'm not sure who's going to be on that one yet. But I accept bribes. Because I make no money. Okay, so you're in Australia.
I am.
And so I am slightly worried that technology will fail us somehow coming across the ocean.
I think it'll be okay.
I hope so.
You see, the internet
is
interconnected.
We've had the internet for days here, like almost as long as we've had electricity and running water.
All right.
And you still have those great white sharks.
Yeah, and I'll have to go and pat my pet kangaroo before I ride it to work.
Put another strip on the Barbie, right?
Oh, gosh. There's so many, like, we are ignorant American jokes.
Yeah,
that I can't imagine. Like, I don't know why you would ever want to talk to an American.
Yeah,
because basically, I was telling people, I was like, "Oh yeah, I got this guy. He's from Australia. Oh, Australia, put another shrimp on the Barbie." I'm like, I can't do that. No. So I find
also
a clever way to work
them
it in.
Prawns,
prawns.
Yeah, well,
like they do in South Africa, right?
Yeah,
I think so. But we don't throw shrimp on the Barbie. We throw prawns on the Barbie.
Yeah, like District 9, right? The prawns? We also
like... Yes.
Yeah.
See?
Sure.
We're all human. No, I saw the thing that you posted on Facebook either yesterday or today. that had like the different areas of Australia, and it's basically thing that can kill you.
Well, yeah, that's Australia. I remember someone was saying, my wife was over in America and a bug flew into the, I think such a small flying insect of some sort. She's like, oh god! And they're like, what are you worried about? It's harmless. Yeah, where I'm from, everything can kill you.
Wow.
I mean, so like, besides the fact that this morning I woke up and realized that I was going to Skype with someone like halfway around the world, and that still, it's still amazing to me that I can talk to someone 12 hours away. What did we decide? You're like 10 hours in the future.
In the future.
Yeah.
Well, wait, no, if it's 6 o'clock here, that's 10 o'clock there in the morning. That's like 16 hours.
16 hours.
Whoa.
Mind blown.
Depends on daylight savings, yeah.
The fact that we're talking to you in the future makes this a sci-fi podcast. Time travel.
That's awesome.
Which makes Mark's question from earlier even more poignant.
Yeah.
What's the future like?
Hoverboards and power laces.
That's right.
Oh, man.
Okay. Well, this is your first time, but you said you listened to a show, so you have a general idea of how bad it's going to be. So that's good.
It'll be fun. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Mark, you ready?
I'm ready.
Jason,
oh, hang on. Let me just shut the door. you have cicadas in America?
We do.
They're particularly bad this year. It's been making recording a pain in the ass because they come up and down in volume and
yeah, they're in the trees.
I'll just shut the door. Hopefully, drown them out. Just like have sex and die already.
I guess.
Oh, like just like crickets?
No, they buzz in the trees for like,
oh, they're so loud,
hours.
Oh,
it's a very North Carolina thing too.
I don't know anything about North Carolina, having lived here my entire life. Way to be a jerk.
Do you guys have Kias there? The bird, not the car? The one that, like, they're really ruthless and they'll come and, like, they can, like, pull mirrors off your car. They have them in New Zealand. That is always a horror story of New Zealanders, and I know that it's kind of down in that region.
It's basically the same thing.
Well, no, but...
Actually, you can say that my parents are from New Zealand, so when I want to wind them or any of my relatives from New Zealand up, I just call it an eastern suburb of Sydney.
Well, you know, it's the same region, and those birds are like, I asked somebody, you know, who went to New Zealand frequently, I said, well, what's the, he's like, because he said the same thing, everything there can kill you, and I said, well, what's the worst thing? He's like, it's actually these annoying birds called Kias. That's where you get the name for the car, and they're
because
really,
it's going to kill you?
Which
yeah,
I was
we
like,
have cockatoos that will do that.
Okay.
They're pretty aggressive. Well, they can be pretty destructive, and we've seen them. We used to live in an apartment, my wife and I, and one of the neighbors used to feed the cockatoos that would, like, land on their balcony.
Oh,
and
wow.
One day they went home and the cockatoos turned up and they're making noise and no one was coming out. So they just tore the, they had, like, a wind chime and stuff and they just destroyed it. And
yeah,
it just flew
yeah.
off. It's like, you're not going to feed us? Fine!
That's it. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. That's what kids do. That's
yeah.
so funny. Amazing.
It's like, some kind of post-apocalyptic
yeah.
movie script there.
Maybe the birds.
Post-apocalyptic. So
birds
it's like
down
a,
under.
Yeah. It's like a metaphor.
Birds Down Under. That sounds like a fantastic movie. I would watch that.
It sounds like a Sharknado quality film.
Indeed.
And yet, Sharknado making tons of money.
Yeah.
You know.
Have you seen it?
I have not.
It's actually, well... Actually, even by the standards of sort of asylum films, it's really, really poorly continuity edited,
mm-hmm.
but it's
oh, wow.
pretty fun, yeah. but it's also unimaginably stupid.
Oh, well, that's what I'm hoping for, because I can enjoy a good bad movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You
it's,
know, just...
it's certainly that. I mean, I just felt the only thing that rubbed me the wrong way was the continuity with it was just appalling.
Well, you know...
And it sort of, it just, like, it really jumped out at me. It's not normally... And I love a good B movie, so
yeah,
it sort of throws you out of the film a bit.
Wow.
You were telling me you're completely engrossed in the Sharknado world, and then at the last minute you're suddenly thrown from that as
basically,
if being
yes,
thrown
that's
by,
what I'm
by
saying,
a Sharknado.
Yes. Well, have you seen the movie Sharktopus, Roger Corman's film?
Sharktopus. What did we watch at Nate's that time? Yeah, it was Sharktopus. Like Crocodile versus or Crocageddon versus
something.
No, so I'm guessing
was it,
no.
Giant, what is it?
Giant.
Was it the one with Debbie Gibson and Tiffany?
I don't
know, but now I want to watch it.
It was
it had Jaleel White in it.
Something or other. Gatoroid versus Mega Python or something. It was awesome.
Was it?
It was so stupid.
Oh, yeah.
Gatorsaurus versus like Megalodon. No, it's not Megalodon.
It had Urkel in it.
Great.
Steve Urkel was in it. That's all I remember. Like, not his character, but the guy who played.
Yeah.
Okay. Check out Sharktopus. It's awesome.
You mean awesomely bad?
Yeah.
Anyway, definitely. But it's just hilarious. It's got what's his name? He's in all those films. played the Master in the Doctor Who movie.
Eric Roberts.
Thank you. Yes, yeah. Eric Roberts. Anyway, indeed. We should probably get on topic.
Talk about a good movie.
Is it good? We don't know. We haven't talked about it yet. All right. Well, I appreciate you being out of your element so you could be on the show.
It's fine.
Okay, but Mark, I feel like I did this like 10 minutes ago.
Already.
Mark,
yes.
You're ready.
Yeah.
Jason, you're ready.
I am.
Actually, Jason, can you pronounce your last name for me?
Rennie.
Just like it looks. I didn't know if it was like Reddy or something.
No,
crazy.
Rennie. Yeah.
Yep. That's me being an American.
Not Renee, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the way it looks.
Okay. So Jason, you're ready. Mark, you're ready. So we will do this.
Okay.
Okay. Welcome to Real World Theology, Episode 17. I am your host, Fizz. On this episode of the podcast, we will be chatting about Saving Mr. Banks, a movie about making a movie. And not just about the making of any movie, but one of the most beloved musicals of all time, Mary Poppins. This telling of the story behind the story is heartwarming at times and also heartbreaking. While there has been some discussion as to the accuracy of the portrayal of how the story played out in real life, versus the film, it is still a remarkable and touching story. So, my guests this week are cornerstone of the show, Mark Winger.
Cornerstone. I've made it that far.
Well, I mean, you've basically been on like half the episodes. Yeah. And joining him is first-time guest, brought to us via the Geek Crossover event, host of the Sci-Fi Show, and first outside the U.S. guest, Australian Jason Rennie.
Hello.
So welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to have you both here to talk about this movie. Actually, I was very excited about talking about this movie like 6 months ago.
Yeah.
So I'm glad we're finally getting to it.
This is one of those where you see the trailer and you immediately like start to tear up. And you're like, this is going to be so good.
Take all my money.
Yeah.
But, okay. So first things first, though. I want to make sure I did this towards the beginning so I didn't forget. I want to take a minute to just encourage any listeners to take a note of the crossover event that is going on right now between a number of us podcasters, a number of we podcasters.
Sure.
Nosotros podcasteros.
Yeah.
I wanted to thank Ben Avery and the Strangers and Aliens guys who put the work in to make this event happen. Like any profession or activity, it's always good to know that you have friends out there. And by putting together this ever-growing group of podcasters, it is building a community of support and information to make our jobs easier, our shows better, and our quality, hopefully, superb. So essentially, we are passing along the savings to you, the customer.
Right.
so you heard it at the beginning of the show, because I'm going to put the bumper at the beginning of the show, and I will give Jason a chance to pimp his work at the end. But check out the show notes where I will have links to all the shows that are participating. They might not be all for everyone, but there are a lot of good shows out there with a lot of good people filling a lot of good niches. So with that said, let's dive into this podcast.
All right.
Yeah. So Saving Mr. Banks is a film starring Tom Hanks as Walt Disney and Emma Thompson as writer and Mary Poppins creator P.L. Travers. The main narrative involves Walt Disney trying to persuade Travers to allow him to adapt her beloved children's character into a film, with Travers resisting until she runs into monetary problems and has to reconsider his 20-year standing offer. Upon doing this, she travels to Southern California, where confrontations ensue because of creative differences between the studio team and Travers, and while Travers herself is reflecting on her difficult childhood. Art, the value of story, the personalness of story, fact versus fiction, family, and the redemptive power of story, all on the table.
Okay.
And more.
That's a lot of cards.
That's a lot of cards. I'm just saying, like, it hits a lot of notes. So
it'll be done in 5, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it's like 5-10 minutes.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
this was important. Okay, so we want to start this episode like we start every episode, with a small caveat. I want to know if you guys enjoyed the movie, and then because this movie is about making the movie Mary Poppins, just your kind of, do you like Mary Poppins? Or do you, or what is your background, I guess, with Mary Poppins? And as always, guests on Skype get to go first.
Okay. Did I like the film? It was slow, but I don't know. I probably, in all honesty, I probably wouldn't have watched the film if you guys hadn't been doing it this week when I was coming on the show.
Oh, okay.
But no, I did enjoy it. It was a good story. And I probably, like most children of the 70s and 80s, saw Mary Poppins a few times growing up, when I was a kid, and I enjoyed it back then. I didn't know any of the backstory, but yeah, I enjoyed the film. It was interesting. It was actually through a large amount of the film. Every time Tom Hanks was on the screen as, Walt Disney, I was going, that dude's dead and his head is frozen in a freezer, and that's weird.
I actually had the same thought.
Really?
Yeah, I was actually, he is frozen.
Yeah.
And they're gonna try to thaw him out.
Wow.
whenever they cure cancer or whatever he had.
That's weird.
Yeah. It's really weird.
It's really weird.
I mean, and this isn't even something I plan to talk about, but like, how weird is that?
It's actually kind of cool.
I get that. So, it was, you know, that was just sort of constantly popping up in the back of my mind occasionally when I was watching the film.
Well, I'll ask you this. Mark and I both were trying to familiarize ourselves with some of your work just so we kind of get an idea for some of your background and stuff. And like I said, I know most of the stuff that you've dealt with, at least on your podcast, is sci-fi. So this is kind of outside of that. But yeah, on your podcast, I think the last one dealt with immortality.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, where does Walt Disney fit into that?
Oh, indeed.
You know? I mean, like, his trying to cheat death.
Yeah.
I mean, do you want to be frozen? I mean, like, how else do you I don't know how to phrase that question any better. Like, would you ever want to be frozen and hope, like, someone...
Oh, I don't know.
Like, unfreezes you, like...
Well, technically, it's the only way you could time travel, by freezing yourself and then waking up, but then you couldn't go back. I mean, I don't know, is that...
But then it'd be like Futurama, you'd have a machine that only takes you forward in time, and you have to just go all the way around.
You have to go all the way around, yeah. Would I want to be frozen? No, not particularly, but I'm a Christian, I'm going to live forever.
Indeed.
There you go.
I mean, it's the wrong... I don't think I'm going to, you know, I don't think I'm merely this physical body. I don't think I'm going to cease to exist when I die. So,
yeah. Yeah, which is actually...
It doesn't hold a lot of appeal.
Right.
Actually, as I said in the immortality episode,
yeah.
At least looking at science fiction, one of the interesting things is everybody seems to want to live forever, except the ones that do.
They all seem to want to die. Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's one of the things that always bother me when I was growing up, because I remember, you know, Walt Disney very briefly,
mm-hmm.
like being on screen and doing his little pre things before it was who was the guy that came after him?
Michael Eisner.
Yeah. You know, Michael Eisner would do like mm-hmm. the I'm previewing the Disney movie that you see on Sunday night or whatever. So right, I saw a couple of Walt Disney things, and I remember hearing about him, and before I was really articulate in my faith, or as articulate as I am now, for what that's worth.
Mm-hmm.
I remember thinking about how sad it was to be like, you're grasping at like life as it's the only thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about like if he would have had a crappy life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the only one you had. And now it gets sort of depressing. I mean, like,
you got that from the intro that he did to the movie of the week or whatever.
No, I remember seeing him, and like while I was watching him up there doing his thing, then hearing what happened to him, like, you know, it's one thing to hear about like a science fiction thing. Oh, these people are frozen, you know, Star Trek. Mm-hmm. People are frozen. We find their spaceship flying around and we unfreeze them. It's one thing, you know, that's science fiction. But to actually think that, like, this guy that I saw, you know, when I was a kid, now is frozen somewhere, wherever he is frozen at, hoping that he will be cured and live longer.
Yeah.
Assuming that he is not technically dead, you know, depending on, I don't check his vitals, but I mean, like, it was depressing for me as a kid, and I really didn't understand why it was depressing for me. And looking back, it's like, it points to something that a hole that I have. Like, I hope my life isn't just what I have here.
It's the real life Demolition Man.
Yes.
Where Demolition Man with Stallone and Wesley Snipes, and they were both frozen. And then, like, for some reason they woke up, you know, like, in the future to fight again.
Because of plot.
Yeah, because of Stallone.
Because of plot, yeah.
Or lack of plot. Yeah. Whatever. Whichever way you want to put it. Well, I mean,
it was a fun film, though.
That was a fun movie.
Yeah, I mean, watching it now, I can't imagine that I would enjoy it near as much. But
I watched it about a year ago, and I quite enjoyed it. It was still, I mean, you know, it was a silly throwaway. Well, it's not great art, but it's certainly fun.
Yeah, exactly.
It's no Mary Poppins.
Like, I think most Stallone movies you could say that about, like Judge Dredd. I love Judge Dredd, but it's a horrible movie. You know, Law.
I grew up on the Judge Dredd comics. Don't disjudge. No, it's fine. I grew up on those comics. I love the comics
versus that is different,
right?
I actually thought we're getting really off topic here. I actually thought the original Judge Dredd movie captured the universe really well, although, like, the look of the universe was right, but the feel of the characters was all wrong. And the new one they did, the feel of the characters was exactly right, but the universe didn't look right.
No. Yeah, it was. I actually just watched the only reason that's on my mind is because I watched Dredd the other night for no reason other than I told my wife that I was like, I want to watch a dumb movie. And she's like, really? Like, you have all these movies you need to watch that are, like, coming out. They're going to be nominated for Oscars. And you want to watch Dredd?
Yeah!
I was like, argh! But, well, okay, so pseudo back on topic. So let's try and meander back. Yeah, so there always was one thing about being frozen that I thought would be cool, and that was the concept that I could wake up when, like, in Star Wars time. Or not Star Wars time, but Star Trek time.
Yeah.
You know, space travel, all these really cool things, but I mean, I really feel like you kind of put it the best, Jason. You know, I am already, based on my beliefs, going to be living forever.
Yeah.
So, you know, compared to, I guess, eternity with the creator of the universe, you know, phasers aren't that cool, maybe.
Maybe there's...
We'll have plenty of time to work on them.
Maybe there's phasers in heaven.
There's phasers in heaven. Hold on.
I think that's the title of the podcast.
The title of this episode for Saving Mr. Banks is Phasers in Heaven. All right.
So.
Okay, so Mark, did you enjoy the movie?
How do I follow this up? I don't...
I really think Disney would have... He would have a lightsaber, probably.
Yeah, probably. Actually, they do have lightsabers now. Disney owns Star Wars.
That's right.
Wow. See how this all works. I liked the movie. I did think it was a little slow, a little dragged out. But nonetheless, I mean, I liked how it presented redemption and forgiveness and did it all as a, you know, I grew up with Disney, and I've always loved Disney and Disney World and anything Disney related. I've always been a fan of. So to kind of go back in time a little bit, see the behind the scenes of making of a Disney film was really interesting, even though I have still yet to this day never seen Mary Poppins. So it was a little bit interesting because I knew the story. I know the movie. I've seen snippets of the movie throughout my life, but I've never sat down and watched the whole movie back to back. I know the scene with, you know, dancing with the penguins, you know, the animated penguins, that was a hot topic in the movie. And so I don't have much of a background with that particular movie, but I have a big Disney background. So to be able to kind of see how the magic, quote unquote, works, I was pretty cool. So I enjoyed it, and I thought it was a very well-made film, well-acted film, even if it was a touch slow.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I also enjoyed the film. I feel like my expectations were so incredibly high for this film. Like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, I was really hoping about 6 months out when I saw the first trailer that this was going to be like the best film of the year.
Yeah.
And so I don't think there was any way for this film to meet those expectations.
Right.
Unfortunately. But I thought, you know, it kind of went back and forth to me on me liking it and kind of being meh. That, you know, the official meh term.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I mean, I look back on it and I enjoyed it. I felt like it was a little, it wrapped things up in too nice of a bow at the end.
A little bit.
Which, you know, and I don't want to be down on happy endings, I guess, but I did, like I said, it just for the struggle that they had going all movie, I felt like at the end it was like, oh, and story's redemptive, so the end of the movie.
Right.
And I felt like it didn't hit home like it could have, even though there were lots of powerful emotional moments. And I felt it was well acted. I usually don't like, was it Clive? Is that who it was?
Who was the dad?
Who was Travers?
Oh, Colin.
Colin. There you
Colin
go.
Colin Farrell. Yeah.
Colin Farrell.
There we go.
I usually don't like Colin Farrell. Mm-hmm. I mean, not like I hate him,
right,
but like he usually is never doing it for me, but I was really impressed by even his performance in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably my favorite character is Paul Giamatti's character.
Oh yeah.
He was good, wasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he was exceptionally good. Which I want to get to in a moment because he was one of the characters that didn't exist. Like he was not someone who was there in real life.
Mm-hmm.
He was completely made up for the film just to kind of give Emma Thompson's character like a bridge.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Kind of to the audience.
I noticed at the end when I was sort of just watching the credits, they had photos of, well, I assumed, perhaps I've assumed wrongly, they'd have like the actor's name, and then I thought it was a photo of the original person. And then for Paul Giamatti, they had, I don't know, some guy standing next to a limo. I just thought, oh.
Well, from what I read,
yeah,
he was one of the people that was completely made up.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. Interesting. Well, I mean, I thought... one thing I really liked was the historicity for a $3 word there, but like everything was like right on historically. So it was, you know, I thought they really did a lot of really good work with the detail, and so that lended itself to it being a better film. And I mean, I think where they kind of started steering wrong was actually the flashback stuff when it was actually because I liked Colin Farrell and I really enjoyed his performance, but I thought it was a little too cliche the way that they portrayed the whole thing.
A Disney film being heavy handed?
Oh, I mean, you know, a little ham fisted. I mean, yeah, I mean, I think it was even a little ham fisted for even a Disney film, because this is a Disney film,
yeah,
which a lot of people don't necessarily realize.
Yeah, a Disney film about how great Disney is.
Yeah.
Well,
and that's the thing. Like a lot of people talked about, you know, how they didn't really address any of the skeletons in Disney's closet and stuff like that. Of course, you know, they say in the movies more about Travers and stuff. But ironically enough, I just thought this. Ironically enough, a skeleton in Disney's closet is now actually Disney himself.
Well, I guess not technically a skeleton.
He's not a skeleton yet. a frozen body in his closet.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that I wanted to kind of address. I mean, because this movie is based on a true story.
Yeah.
You know, how far can someone stray from real life before it ruins the impact that the story kind of lands?
I've never had a problem with... I mean, a lot of people get really upset when a film isn't 100% historically accurate, which... Based on the nature of filmmaking, nothing can ever really be 100% historically accurate. You know, and I've never had a problem with a film being a piece of art that tries to project a picture of something to, you know, basically give its themes off and you know, tell the story it wants to tell. I mean, I understand that movies have... It really kind of speaks to the power that movies have... over us to influence our culture is that people get upset over it because if it's not historically accurate, people are going to mess up the facts and think that the movie, what the movie portrayed, is actually what happened. But I've never had a problem with that because a movie is in itself a piece of art. It's self-contained. It is what it is. And they use, with all other movies that are based on a true story, they just kind of use that as they need to tell the story they want to tell with the film. They're not necessarily telling the actual story word for word, minute by minute. I would think that, for me, that's like a documentary. You know, if I wanted that, I'd go see a documentary, you know. So I've never had a problem with that. I think that this film, as historically accurate as it was, I mean, they probably had all kinds of things wrong historically that we don't know about. But, I mean, What's this movie about? It's about Travers and redemption and about, you know, the stuff that happened in her life and how this event kind of played into that. And now they're telling a story about more, less about the actual story that happened, more about redemption and forgiveness and saving Mr. Banks.
Yeah. So as long as they convey.
Yeah. What do you think, Jason?
I was going to say, do you know if at the end, Travers starts writing again, and do you know if that happened? I was wondering that myself. I was wondering that at the end. Was that just tacked on to sort of make it look like she's come full circle and everything's happy and rosy again, or was that actually what happened?
Mark's going to find that out for us right now.
I'm going to Google that, because I meant to look that up and find out if she ever had any more, you know, what more Mary Poppins books there were and all that stuff, but I never looked that up. So.
Well, what it reminds me of is, well, actually, I guess I could say this first. There was some backlash about this not being completely accurate, but I think most of it came from Disney, like people being afraid that Disney's writing propaganda for their own company.
Yeah.
You know, like Disney's rewriting history, I guess. Because, I mean, in the movie, to me, Disney comes out looking pretty good. You know, he comes in, he delivers something from like a stubborn old woman that didn't want to share her stuff with the world and make kids happy. And he's just, you know, doing the Disney thing. So I didn't think
she came across that way, actually. I mean, like, she was a stubborn old woman that didn't want to share her book with the world, but I didn't think it was... I guess I could see why you'd say she was that, but it seemed like... Well, I thought, at least the way it was portrayed... It wasn't so much she didn't want to share it with the world. She was just, and sort of Disney convinced her that she was scared that it would be destroyed and what it meant to her would. Well, it was like that scene where just before Disney goes and visits her, he's sitting there going, "Well, this guy approached me about Mickey, and there was no way I could give up Mickey. That was like, it was giving up family." And so I just thought it was. Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm assuming that was the inference I was supposed to draw, but
yeah,
I thought that was like he understood her at that point. It's like he got where she was coming from, and then when he could make her understand, "I understand where you're coming from. I know why this matters to you. Trust me, I won't ruin it for you." And then, well, you know, she gets on board with it because she's seen, "I can trust you with this." She takes a leap of faith, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, she's
a reasonably justified one, but still, you know.
Well, that's what that's what the movie is about. She is protective of this character and doesn't want to give it away, and the story is why. And the why is that it means a great deal to her, and perhaps, you know, to the point where it's too much of an obsession for her to hang on to. As we kind of see in the film, she has, you know, the ghost of her father kind of haunting over her. And that's why she wants to be very protective of the Mary Poppins character, because of what she means to her. And she doesn't want to see it, you know, I guess bastardized with animation and just sing song and kind of glazing over the theme and the point and how much Mary Poppins can really, the character really means to the family and that kind of thing. And so that's why you kind of see that conflict of like Disney really doesn't understand at first who the character is, and he, you know, she says to him at one point, you know, oh, you think she came to save the children, and you realize he doesn't even really get it at that point. So it's a struggle to kind of understand. And I mean, I understand why people think that Disney came off in the movie as kind of rosy and, you know, magical and all that, but I don't think it matters to lay all the skeletons out about Disney, because the movie's not about him. And I felt like he was more of he's one of those characters that you put in a story to kind of be a springboard for the actual character who's the main point. And I thought he was, you know, there to kind of be a mirror to kind of bring out aspects of Travers. And you really see that in that, you know, penultimate scene where he's saying, you know, I understand I had a father who was very much, I had my own Travers Goff. I had my, you know, this childhood story that he gives about the whole thing. And it really, it's like they both come to understand what all of this means. And that's how the story gets made, assumingly, yeah, according to the film.
Well, one of the things before we hit completely on story that really stood out to me, and I was wondering if it was something that, I guess it made you guys think about, was how holding on to our past, how basically saying that I'm not going to be that way in our past, or from things that happened into your past, basically allow those things to really tighten their grip on you later in life. You know, like, I'm not going to be like my parents, or I'm not going to just dream. Like, in this particular case, P.L. Travers is, you know, saw her father. Her father encouraged her to dream, encouraged to be free-spirited, didn't really worry with the day-to-day cares of money or jobs or, you know, practicality. And it seems like she turned around and said, okay, that basically drove him to alcoholism and ruined our family and traumatized me for life. And so I'm never going to be that way again. You know, don't teach kids that they can just do whatever. You know, you have to teach them structure. You have to teach them that they need to go to their education. And, you know, she says things like this in the future. And what she does is that memory has more control over her than it ever did before. I mean, is that just me?
I mean, you're saying that she once, you know, her father's imagination and that influenced her life, and then he kind of ended up ruining the family with being an alcoholic and ultimately dying and leaving them, you know, behind. You're saying that that made her kind of go opposite from imagination? Because I thought that one of the most interesting things to me about this whole story, about her and about learning about her, is that she had this whole imaginative father who she could have been just angry at for the rest of her life and, you know, bitter about. She kept the imagination. She wrote Mary Poppins.
Well, she did. But at the same time, you know, when they're going through the script and she's in the room with the writer and the song guys, and they're like, oh, I can't remember exactly what the scene was, but, you know, they're like, oh, well, she's going to do this. And they're like, children just can't do that. You know, children have to learn responsibility and stuff like this. And that was the opposite. And I feel like that was a pain from her past that, you know, she thought she was fixing or leaving. You know, I'm doing better than this because that's not what I'm about now. Mm-hmm. But it's still a form of your past controlling you. When all your decisions are to prevent something,
yeah,
it still has power over you.
Absolutely.
Probably more power than it would if you, I guess, owned up to it and let it have influence on you.
Because you're still in denial at that point.
Right.
Well, because it's got veto power over everything at that point, in a sense.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's very, you know, I think that's what this whole film is about. Her not even realizing that that is what's affecting her. Because, again, she wrote Mary Poppins, which is this very imaginative, you know, whimsical kind of look at life. And yet you see her character when it comes to, like, being very fanciful and whimsical. She's, like, totally against it, like you're saying. And so it's like she doesn't even realize the duality of what she's doing with her life. Does that make sense? You know what I'm saying?
No, yeah, I'm with you.
So, I mean, that's why I thought this, I mean, this, even though, like, you know, most films are kind of based on a certain structure and everything, and this one followed it really well. I thought this seemed like a very kind of new story, almost, you know, why somebody wrote something and created something and kind of, you know, they're not even realizing that their own dual nature is kind of conflicting and not letting something happen that could, you know, affect people and really touch people. And I know this has been done before. There's nothing new under the sun, certainly, but it felt very refreshing kind of a take on a film for me. So, and just kind of any story about redemption, I'm kind of a sucker for. So that's why we're talking about this is her redemption from what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, Jason, the question I have for you, that I hope doesn't put you too on the spot is, like, I mean, is there any character in particular that you felt yourself gravitating towards, like more than another? Because I felt like this movie did a lot of like empathizing with lots of different characters and trying to kind of fit a niche. I mean, did you find yourself kind of like rooting for anyone in particular or identifying with anybody?
I don't know. You haven't put me on the spot or anything. No.
Yeah.
I felt empathy for the poor, the creative guys that were doing the, doing the songwriting, and they're trying their best, and she's just being difficult and stubborn, and, you know, they're trying to please her, they're trying to make her happy, they're trying to just create something great. And she just wants to be difficult and just crap all over it. Yeah. Is what it sort of felt like. I mean, I don't know. I guess the scene where she goes, "I don't want any red in the film," sort of summed it up nicely.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're just going, "That's insane. Why are we doing?" They're just sort of looking at each other going, "We're wasting our time here. What are we doing?" And it's just, I get their frustration. I could sort of feel that. And
yeah, I think we've all had somebody that we've dealt with in that certain capacity. Maybe not, you know, for 2 whole weeks trying to make something.
No,
but you know, like it just, I think, especially creatively, I think, you know, as we are kind of writers and creators, I think we've all dealt with somebody who's been stingy and just wanted to be difficult.
Yeah. Well, and sorry, go.
No, go ahead.
No, I wasn't going to say anything. I was just agreeing. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Well, I think it was pretty remarkable when you think about those two guys, or those brothers, that they were asked over and over again to create something memorable and possibly timeless, and then to constantly give it up and basically die to that creation over and over again. Because they had, you know, not because they felt it was going to make things better, but because that's what they had to do. It kills me when I think about, like, having to do that to any art that I make.
Oh, yeah, and that's really, you know, that they kind of touched on it in the movie, but they didn't really explore it, was that difficulty and their kind of struggle with her. Because, like, I read something about one of the actual guys, the only remaining guy that's still alive that was a part of this story, was one of the writers, one of the musical creators, I forget his name, but he's 85 years old, and so he was on the set watching Jason Schwartzman, who played his character, watching him play piano and do all these things, and he was, you know, feet away from him while they were filming, and he, you know, the story was basically him saying he was cringing and, you know, kind of like having to watch going through all this again. And it was, you know, kind of a fun experience, but it was interesting how much of an effect that had on him, because he's a creator and had to write all these things, and she was very critical and all that. And that's why one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when Disney's sitting outside at night on the bench and he hears the piano playing. And so he goes up to the room where that guy is sitting there playing.
We'll call him Richard Sherman.
Richard Sherman. Thank you. where Sherman is just, he's just in there in the dark with just the light over his keys, playing a song that he just was just singing and playing and enjoying his art. I thought that was a perfect scene to add to the movie, to really kind of speak to the Sherman brothers, their struggle about it, but then just the enjoyment that they had and who they were just for music and being a part of. I've always been kind of swept up in the Disney magic, so I enjoy just kind of even though it can feel very surface and not very deep. I think that's the point, and I think that's a lot of what Disney tried to do with a lot of the magic and stuff. But just being able to kind of rest in that for a moment is something I've always enjoyed. And so to see that portrayed mm-hmm. in the movie through that scene, that was one of my favorite scenes in that movie.
Well, I think it does a lot for it does a lot for me as the audience too, because it makes it makes me believe Disney or believe Tom Hanks as Walt Disney more when he's trying to persuade, Travers later in the film mm-hmm. that he understands how to kind of hone and encourage and treat other people's art.
Right.
Because we see him basically go up there and he super encourages Sherman. Sherman, who's had a difficult time, he obviously loves his art. He does this for he does this for a living with his brother, mm-hmm. and he's doing everything he can, having everything he does torn apart, criticized, told it's stupid.
Yeah.
He makes up a word and then, she's like, making up words, that's silly, and then he has to kind of hide.
I love that scene.
Yeah, hides
I love that scene where they first do it, and she goes, "That's stupid," and you just see him go with the word supercalifragilistic on the front, you see him push it behind.
Oh gosh, I
laughed so hard.
Yeah, it was so subtly kind of, and it was funny.
Yeah.
But it also kind of, you could see kind of like the, oh.
Yeah.
Because he was probably really excited about that.
I mean, you think about the,
back for that.
Yeah, you think about the quintessential made up word. Yeah. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious is the super, perfect made up word. And to think about it, the story in real life, the actual story, for that to actually have gotten made is a huge creative victory.
Mm-hmm.
Because if she was against making up a word, to be able to use the song supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. There you go.
Well, like I said, it does wonders because it really helps me understand Walt Disney as like a mediator. He mm-hmm. really does just want to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of snapping along, just, oh yeah, that's gonna be the one they're singing.
Yep.
It's gonna be it.
Yeah, I mean, I think. Everybody's got backstory and history and skeletons in their closet, I guess. But Walt Disney's probably, has a lot of those or whatever. But I don't feel like that matters. Just being a fan of what his work was, because his work was just to, make everything kind of fanciful and wonderful and kind of escape a little bit, but also just to kind of see the joy in life. Which is a lot of what he gets to say in this film.
Yeah.
Tom Hanks as Disney.
Jason, was there something that you wanted to come back to with the supercalifragilist?
Oh no, I just thought it was great when they're talking about made up words, and then because that song's in the movie.
Oh
and
yeah.
Just the way they hide it. I just thought that was a really wonderful scene. I laughed really, really hard when that came on. I just thought it was hilarious the way they're just going, oh no, how on earth are we going to sell her on this? And you can sort of see all of that thought process in their mind. It was all just summed up in just pushing the half the word on the top of the score for it, just behind the other one. Yeah. That was all summed up, all this whole, oh my god, how are we going to sell her on this, was just summed up in that little action. I just thought it was great.
Yeah, I feel like we've inadvertently skipped to our favorite scenes.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Well, okay, so let's talk story. I think the main crux of this movie comes down to this speech, more or less, that Tom Hanks as Walt Disney gives to Emma Thompson's character.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of goes, we've been talking spoilers the whole time. People listen to this show and don't understand we're going to talk spoilers to talk about narrative themes. Then sorry.
What can you do?
My bad.
Yeah.
I'm the bad
yeah.
guy.
Yeah.
So, he gives this speech and it says, give her to me, Miss Travers. Trust me with your precious Mary Poppins. I won't disappoint you. I swear that every time a person goes into a movie house from Leicester to St. Louis, they will see George Banks being saved. They will love him and his kids. They will weep for his cares and wring their hands when he loses his job. And when he flies that kite, oh, they will rejoice. They will sing in every movie house all over the world, in the eyes and the hearts of my kids and other kids and their mothers and fathers for generations to come. George Banks will be honored. George Banks will be redeemed. George Banks and all he stands for will be saved. Maybe not in life, but in imagination, because that's what we storytellers do. We restore order with imagination. We instill hope again and again and again. Trust me, Miss Travers. Let me prove it to you. I give you my word. Boom.
Boom.
I mean, when I'm watching the movie, I'm like, okay, this is what this movie has been all about.
Yeah. And I loved that scene. I loved that moment where he understands her and he's explaining it to her by helping her understand him. And that gives him license to say that. And then, you know, because, I mean, that scene is the culmination of the entire movie beforehand. And really that the idea that, you know, you go through that's what I think is really powerful about this movie. Is that you go through this whole story of her and how much her father meant to her as a little girl and his mistakes that he just kind of piles on and piles on and piles on, and ultimately it destroys him. And then you understand truly, you know, because the movie it's called Saving Mr. Banks. Mm-hmm. But you understand truly what that means at that moment, because he's saying it's not that just, you know, he's going to be... you're gonna forgive him, which she even says, I don't need to forgive my father, he's a great man, and he says, no, you need to forgive yourself. So it's not even that she's gonna have her own personal forgiveness, but like, this really captures not only this story but the power of story and the power of film universally, in that every theater, every person who sees this movie for generations, years, hundreds of years, this, you know, the lasting effect of this story is going to be that this man is going to be saved over and over and over, redeemed over and over and over. And I really think I've never seen it portrayed very succinctly in a film like this was. It was really interesting. That's why I really like the idea of like the movie about making a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that how they did this was just to kind of see the story along with the making of it, and then it culminate into this and saying, this is what this power has to redeem. And it's not in real life, but imagination counts for something. And I think that's even more true now, because we're just, you know, inundated with film and entertainment constantly. It's a lot of our world is kind of based on that and surrounded by that because of technology.
That's why we have podcasts.
That's why we have podcasts. So I think it's even more true now to see it in that way, just to say that, you know, if you this character is going to be redeemed, and he gets a chance to be redeemed in the hearts and minds of so many people, and that has a lot of power to it.
Oh, that was like, yeah, that was one thing that struck me about, well, actually two things that struck me about the film, or actually about the original Mary Poppins that I hadn't really noticed before, was it's quite a dark story in a lot of ways, this whole redemption of Mr. Banks and all the rest of it, and sort of him neglecting his kids but doing what he has to do to provide for them and things like that. It actually reminded me of, because I sort of didn't catch any of this when I watched this film as a kid. It was just a sort of happy film about this magical nanny and singing and dancing and, you know,
animated penguins.
You miss all this. And it reminded me of, have you seen the original Charlie and the Chocolate Factory?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's a really dark film.
It is.
Which I never picked up on as a kid, and I watched it again not that long ago. I was like, wow. You know. All these kids die. I never really appreciated this. It's really horrible in lots of ways.
Well, I mean, Charlie's entire situation is pretty
grim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty awful before that golden ticket.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
well, that's, I think a lot of, you know, I kind of, and disappointed by a lot of, you know, kids' films nowadays because they're not as dark as they used to be. They're not as, like, true to life as they used to be, which is not necessarily, yeah. you could argue is a good thing or a bad thing.
So you're P.L. Travers. You're like, life's not like that. You need to show kids what life is like.
No, because, I think a movie like Finding Nemo is, you know, a great way to, you know, kind of show both sides of it. And I'm not saying that you don't need to necessarily show the side of life all the time, or you do or don't, whatever. But it's just, you look at a lot of movies back then, back when we were kids or back before we were kids, and they just got really dark and they got really deep into themes that kind of go over your head when you're a kid.
Yeah, exactly. And this is depth to the film. And I quite like that scene where, I don't remember it from the original, but Dick Van Dyke is there and the kids are going, my daddy doesn't love me, and, you know, he doesn't really care for us. And he's going, no, he really does care for you. He really does love you. He's just, he's got to do what he's got to do to provide for you. And I suspect that's a message that would resonate with, I don't know if you had that experience growing up or not. But
if you
sometimes
did,
you feel like your parents are distant and stuff. And when you get older, you appreciate it. I guess when you get to the same situation yourself or things like that, you appreciate, actually, you worked really hard and you sacrificed for me. And I appreciate it. I didn't appreciate it at the time, but I appreciate it now. And yeah, I mean, you see that in Mary Poppins with her, well, in Saving Mr. Banks with her dad, who seems to be an alcoholic, I'm guessing. And he's really not coping with being the branch manager and all the rest of it. It's crushing him, but he does it anyway because he's a man and it's what you do to provide for your family.
Well, and that's why they have that scene where they're, you know, they're singing the song about the bank and stuff.
Yeah,
And she's having that flashback, and she just flips out on him.
Yeah,
you know, and is like, he's not evil, you know, and stuff like that. And I take, you know, points more to that scene in Mary Poppins that I think went over a lot of people's heads, or didn't hit unless you were in that situation.
Well, I mean, it hadn't occurred to me to see it like that, but yeah, and it's like, oh, and. Anyway, yeah.
well, I think she is in that moment. That's a really good scene too. I mean, she kind of has an explosion of emotion, yet it's really kind of one of the first times that she has a truly kind of a righteous anger at them, and kind of her opposition to what they're doing is actually a good thing. You know, because a lot of the film kind of comedically says, you know, a lot of her opposition is just silly and superfluous. But in that moment, she kind of gets her first righteous anger when she says, you don't understand, he's not an evil person. He was never evil. He was never a bad guy. And I wonder, I mean, they didn't really portray what they were trying to say about the character in the script necessarily at that point in this movie. But I think that, you know, she kind of had to steer them away from that to say, he's not a bad guy. You know, he's not this evil person. And she kind of goes overboard a little bit emotionally, but I thought that was a really important moment.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, but isn't that kind of the problem with lots of movies like this that are more feel good movies than actual movie? Well, I guess movies that are grounded in some kind of ultimate truth, because she's like, he's not a bad guy. And you're like, oh, okay, I can see he's not bad, but you can't really explain what's bad and what's good. You can just be like, okay, I can give him the benefit of the doubt. You can never really define good or bad.
I actually thought this older style movie in Mary Poppins, where Dick Van Dyke is explaining to the kids, no, your father's not like, I know you don't understand this, and I know you can't make sense of this, but trust that your dad loves you. I mean, isn't that, well, I don't know what your experience of being a Christian is like, but I feel like that a lot.
Yeah.
Like, I know you love me, God. I know you sent Christ. I know I'm redeemed. I don't know what the hell you're doing.
Yes.
What's going on? This doesn't make any sense to me. I don't understand. But I trust you.
Ding. Yeah, it's very. Yeah, I mean, this is kind of. Of course, we look at, you know, story as a Christian, as a the biblical story is the meta narrative, of course, and you kind of see that nuance there in this, of course, and I was going to address kind of like the idea of a quote unquote feel good movie. I know it's a term that's used a lot, but I've always kind of rejected the idea of a feel good movie, because I think there are movies. I think films ultimately portray some aspect of existence, of life, whether it's sci-fi or drama or whatever. Yet some just don't do it as well, you know. And I think the idea of a feel-good movie is that, you know, it's just another movie that it maybe takes a lighter approach, but the themes are still there. I mean, that's, you know, that's what this podcast is about, you know, that there's always entertainment is not mindless. And I think the idea of a quote unquote feel-good movie is lending itself to saying that entertainment is mindless. So it's, I don't think this movie is a feel-good movie by that traditional what people mean when they say that by any means, because I think it digs a lot into some really tough stuff with her backstory. Like, actually, my wife particularly was, you know, the next day she was like, I keep thinking about her horrible childhood and what she had to go through with him, and it just makes me sad. And I was like, that's really interesting that, I kind of saw it as another, you know, part of the story, but it really had an impact on her. So that really doesn't qualify this as a feel-good movie.
She had a horrible childhood.
No, not at all.
She hates her parents.
Not at all.
And they're listening right now.
It's also clear now.
Yeah. Confession brought to you by Real World Theology. Yeah. No, but I really don't think this is a, you know, and like I said, I don't like that they're a feel-good movie, but I feel like this... Anytime you have a movie with Walt Disney in it, you're going to have his themes of life and his ideology of life come around. And I think that it's just a fanciful take on very real things. Because a lot of, you know, you look at a lot of the early Disney movies too, and they were very realistic and dealt with some dark themes. And, you know, so I kind of reject the notion that dealing with life in a very magical way, as kind of Walt Disney would do it, takes away from learning the themes of something and the themes of life and learning a lesson about life and even God and our creator and, you know, who we are and all that, and our existence. And, you know, I think you can tackle a lot of that in a very gritty way, or you could tackle that in a very fanciful way. And that's why, you know, like when you see that scene in the movie where Dick Van Dyke's character is saying that, you know, he basically says, you know, I think your father's in prison. I think he's in a cage. There's all kinds of different shapes of sizes of cages, and his is a bank. I mean, you know, Dick Van Dyke kind of talks like this through the movie. You know, he's very, you know, holy jolly.
That's true.
Holy jolly day with Barry, whatever. Yeah. I don't know if that's, Australian or anything. He's kind of got it's a Cockney accent, I think.
Yeah,
anyway,
I think it is.
Yeah, it's very... Fizz was trying to pick on me about my terrible Cockney
what?
Accent.
I would never do that. I would never belittle your art.
Right. But if you think about it in that sense, it's a very jolly kind of way of very saying a very, very, hard-hitting theme.
So it becomes like Robin Hood Men in Tights. You know, maybe if you tell me the bad news in a good way, it won't sound so bad.
Maybe, exactly. You know, but you say the point of, like, you can... There's all kinds of ways to approach a theme, but the theme stays the same.
Well...
Yes.
So I took this big speech, and I looked at some of the exact phrases that come out of Disney's mouth, and I realized, to me, that it seems to be reflecting desires and truths that we all have, because I think we're all down with his speech. Like, we're all completely on board. We're sold in. We're pushing all our chips to the middle because we're completely on board with what the speech that Disney gives to Travers. But I think the funny thing is that all it really does is show us something that we actually long for that is even better than what he says.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, he says George Banks will be redeemed, which, you know, why does he need to be redeemed in a world that's just this life? Why do we have to redeem people that are dead? They're gone. Let's just keep going. You know, why are we trying to redeem him? His that doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
We have this understanding that things need to be redeemed. And so then he goes on and says, you know, he'll be honored, and all he stands for will be saved, but not in life, but mm-hmm. in imagination. And when I heard that, I was like, that sounds great.
Yeah.
But wouldn't it be great, and not to be too heavy-handed, but wouldn't it be great if there was a story told by a storyteller that didn't just redeem things or people or actions in imagination? What if it redeemed them in life?
Yeah.
What if it actually redeemed them?
I think I know of a story like that.
Exactly. So, and that's why if you take that concept and then go even further, you know, he says we restore order with imagination. I would say that we restore order with truth and the truths that we find.
Mm-hmm.
We might use our imagination to retell them or to, you know, to spin them or whatever. But, you know, we restore order with truth.
Yeah.
And I think that's the beauty of a film like this, because he gives us a lot of truths. They're using the word imagination and, you know, talking very ethereally and creatively about it and using terms like art and story. But we, you know, as Christians, we had a storyteller who came to Earth, told lots of stories,
mm-hmm.
you know. He loved telling stories
mm-hmm.
because he knew it was way better than saying, do this, don't do that. Or better than doing that, he goes, well, let me tell you a story.
Mm-hmm.
Let me redeem this situation with some truth that kind of affects your imagination. And I feel like if we believe that we're all created in that image, that we're all like him somehow,
mm-hmm.
then mm-hmm. that's how we understand things. You know, the Ten Commandments were nice, but they're very straightforward. It's not very practical. And Christ can, let me tell you a story that basically is, you know, thou shalt not commit adultery, but let me show you what that looks like. Not just let me tell you not to do it.
Right.
And that's, and through, you know, through his stories and stuff, through his life, you know, we have that redemption through that greater story. And so I think this movie has a lot of heart, but I don't want to say it's a feel good movie, but I think since it doesn't specifically, or since it tries to kind of sugarcoat the power of true story, and mm-hmm. like I said, calls truth imagination or things like that, that it almost is a feel-good story because it didn't have that punch I wanted it to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it did call to something that I completely agree with and believe in, but I think it does it accidentally.
Hey.
Yeah.
I can.
Boom.
Like I said, I don't want to be too heavy-handed with it.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, like I said, one of the linchpins of this show and the understanding of what we try to do is that whether they mean to or not,
right,
they're telling a story that reflects longings in people,
mm-hmm.
that reflects truth about humanity, desires of humanity. They may call it something different, but that's why we resonate with it, because we want it.
Yeah, and it's funny that you mention it in that sense, because when he was having that conversation with her at the end of the movie, or towards the end of the movie, where he gives that big speech before it, he's saying, you know, I found the exact quote, you know, he says, it's all about him, isn't it? All of this, everything. And then he says, forgiveness, it's what I learned from your books. And what I thought there was, I learned from forgiveness from a book too.
Yeah.
Just wasn't a Mary Poppins book. It was the Bible, you know. And I think that's for us as Christians, we see it as that is a resonating echo off of who Christ is, and what Christ can do is forgive, ultimately not in imagination, but actually in real life. And so it that really resonated for me, and that's kind of helped resonate, you know, through that big speech again, because of what you're saying and that exact thing, because I understand. And really, I think overall, just to speak as, because he's really talking about what storytellers do there. And what I see as storytellers do is they're telling bits and pieces of themes that you pull from what is ultimately the meta narrative, the overall overarching narrative of the gospel. And I think that, you know, this movie did it very well, that it resonated, but I think all stories do it in some regard, whether they realize it or not, which is the point of the podcast again.
Well, this podcast certainly seems very important all of a sudden.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I think one of the other things that it talks about too is when you have, you know, well, Disney says, you know, George Banks will be redeemed, George Banks will be honored, but he also says, aren't you tired, Miss Travers? We all have our tales, but don't you want to find a way to finish the story? Mm-hmm. Let it all go and have a life that isn't dictated by a past. I mean, like,
yeah.
I mean, that's my own personal call for redemption.
Oh yeah,
you know, that's it Disney is, saying, like, don't you want to be redeemed? Like, personally,
yeah.
You know, and unfortunately, I don't think that putting Mary Poppins on the screen is gonna, you know, redeem her completely.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to help her. It seems to kind of cope with what happened in the past. But it doesn't fully redeem her. And I mean, we all have bad stories. So, I mean, like, I feel like the whole Travers backstory is something that even if you didn't have a bad family life, you know that you came from somewhere and your life wasn't perfect.
Right. Well, yeah. I think the idea of a, you know, talking about a feel-good movie, if, you know, for what you want that definition to be, is the fact that, you know, if they were to just say, you know, that this is kind of what happened to her and kind of leave it at that and not really bring in that redemption thing, I think if you look at this redemption story as is and just kind of say, oh, that's sweet, then you don't really understand that I feel like, from what I believe, everybody needs to be redeemed. And so, like, anytime I'm really drawn to stories of redemption because I know how badly I need to be redeemed as a human being. And I think, you know, when you look at story and when you look at the overall nature of redemption in film, in any regard, I think people relate to that because they know some aspect of their life needs to be redeemed. And I feel like maybe a feel-good movie would gloss over that, but I don't feel like this film did, even though it did it in a very kind of light way. You know what I'm saying? Like, they approach... There's a lot of comedy in this movie.
Yeah.
There's a lot of light moments and stuff like that. But there's still a lot of, you know, gritty redemption that needs to happen. And I really... You know, that resonated with me. I think that's why this film has resonated with a lot of people. And I think that's why redemption stories resonate with people, is because we do need to be redeemed. Is that another boom moment?
Yeah,
boom.
I think...
Boom, that's it.
But difficult to disagree with that. So,
well, I mean, do you have any other thoughts on, like, the whole his big speech, Jason? Like, I don't want to cut you out. Like, I know the hardest part of having someone on Skype is you can't tell when someone, like, wants to talk.
Yeah. Look at those visual cues.
I need some little key that sort of furiously, like, is me raising my hand or some little icon raising its hand.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah. Oh, it's like one of those awful, like. You have those webinars and stuff?
Yeah, chats. The ding, you punch in.
You have to raise your hand.
Your digital hand.
Oh, gosh, those are awful. Speaking of tangents.
Yeah.
I don't know. The film was a little weird in the sense that I probably never would have watched it, except for you guys inviting me on, as I said. But I did enjoy it. I find that a lot, though, because my wife wants to watch things, and it's just like... I suppose. And then like, I enjoy it. So.
Like Downton Abbey. Oh, God.
Never watched it, but
if you have a wife, you might end up watching Downton Abbey, which is actually a good first season. But that's another podcast.
Well, I mean, like, well, gosh, this is totally a tangent. Dang it,
it's just the tangent show.
Well, I was gonna ask if you. I mean, I know you already said that you like Doctor Who, Jason, but like, do you have like a inherent like resentment for all things British? Does that culturally still happen in Australia?
Maybe for some people. No, I love Britain. Well, I don't know. I think Britain as a culture today is in the toilet. That's a totally different conversation. But
yeah.
I love Britain and its history, and I like a lot of the TV it produces. I love British comedy.
Oh yeah.
I love British comedians. Well, I generally speaking like British comedians and can't, as a general rule, stand American comedians. Yeah. Even though the British comedians swear more and worse.
Yeah.
It never feels as bad. Because it's just really natural. Yeah, and it always feels really forced with American comedians. Mm-hmm. I love British. I like British sort of drama and culture and comedy and all of that. Oh, and I really enjoy it. So.
Which is funny that you kind of bring up the British-Australian thing with this movie, because she was Australian and moved to Britain.
I'm sure you recognize lots of the locations of
Sure, most of them shot in my backyard.
Yes.
Australia, very small country.
Very small. But that was one of the things.
It was that scene with the guy who had a kangaroo on a leash.
Yeah.
I was definitely left going, did that ever happen? I've never seen that. The only place I see kangaroos are in zoos or occasionally when you run into them with your car. And that's really bad because they're really solid. But
it's like hitting a deer here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, the wombats here are worse. They're just like hitting a small concrete block and they'll destroy your car and they just wander off. They're amazing.
Good luck with that, dude.
Like ankle sores.
Yeah. Anyway.
Another tangent. That's funny because I mean I didn't realize that until now. You know, she was Australian.
I think I had that in my original copy of my show notes. I was like, mention that she's from Australia and there's a thing. And
imagine that.
No, instead we'll just talk about.
Imagine there's other people from Australia.
There's other people in the world. That's mind blown.
Actually,
I always look at those sort of old timey portrayals of Australia. Nothing like that. And I live in relatively rural Australia. I can wander out on my balcony and see some small farms with horses and cows and things.
And
so I sort of actually live in the area is classed as rural. I don't live in Sydney. I live sort of north of Sydney a bit. We bought a house because it was affordable. But
it sounds you know what? It sounds like everywhere else in the world.
Yeah,
probably.
People go out and buy an affordable house in an affordable area. It can happen anywhere. Well, actually, I had a follow-up question for you, though, Jason. You said that you wouldn't normally watch this movie on your own. Is there a particular reason why? Do you only kind of find yourself gravitating towards certain movies, or do you ever branch out and try something that you wouldn't normally watch? Or I think it pertains to this movie. I think it pertains to this movie.
I could accidentally out myself as a rom-com fan or something.
Yeah.
I'm not.
I think it pertains to this movie because, I mean, this movie has its own kind of...
His favorite movie is Australia.
No, I normally like science fiction movies. I love B movies, and I like sort of action movies and things like that. I'm of simple tastes, but
I
enjoy this. I should branch out more than I do because I usually enjoy it when I do. But
there's only so many hours in the day, man.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, what was it about this movie that made you go, I probably won't watch that?
Oh, just here's a story. Here's a story of something that happened not that long ago about making a film, and it just seems boring. It just doesn't grip me.
Typical American stuff. Like, this happened so long ago.
Yeah.
Over 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Not even that. It just didn't seem like it was all that exciting. Like, I enjoyed I'm looking forward to watching, is it Lone Survivor? About the SEAL team that got ambushed.
Yeah.
I'm keen to see that. I think I'll really enjoy that. And I liked, I loved Act of Valor. Like those sort of, and they're sort of telling real stories. And I really enjoyed them. But that's the sort of real story I like. And this is... Mm-hmm. But it turns out I enjoyed this, but it's not the sort of real story I sort of automatically want to go and see.
Right. So if Paul Giamatti would have gotten out of the limo with like two weapons under his coat and started
mowing,
been
there, yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed. I've never read any Jane Austen, but I loved Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies.
Yeah,
so.
I've wanted to read that.
So whenever they're taking Travers, like, from the airport to the Disney
studio. To a post-apocalyptic war zone. I'd be there.
It's like Paul Giamatti in the front, and sitting next to him, Samuel Jackson.
Yes!
Instantly make this movie better.
It would. No, but yeah, exactly. You know, I would have gone, ooh, that sounds really good.
What is your problem?
Yeah. And other colorful language.
That won't be on the podcast.
So,
okay.
Are we done?
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, the biggest thing is we hit on the story part.
Yeah.
And I think that was the, like, unlike a lot of the movies we do where I think some of the narrative references are fairly subtle, or I think they're woven in a lot deeper. So we kind of have to pull them out. Mm-hmm. This one, I believe, like, culminated at one point in the movie, and everything else was kind of like peaking to that point.
Yeah.
So there were some other things that were noteworthy that we could talk about, but, you know, we're about that time anyway. So we'll move on. And so, as we do on every show, after we do the main conversation, we skip straight to our come on moments,
mm-hmm.
which now for me is probably that Samuel Jackson was not in this movie. Come on.
Yeah. Not enough explosions. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Jason, what I mean, like, I know it's not typically your genre, but what about this movie just made you kind of roll your eyes?
Actually nothing. That's the thing. I actually, the movie was a bit slow and it dragged a bit, but I like the old Twilight Zone and those can be pretty slow too.
Mm-hmm.
We're
actually just talking about that.
We were.
I love the Twilight Zone. Anyway,
stay out there.
Focus on topic.
Stay out. I
really enjoyed the film. I mean, it was a bit slow, and I was a bit on and off watching it. But when I sort of got into it, there wasn't anything that really made me roll my eyes. I really enjoyed it. I mean, I just thought it was a nice. It was a good narrative. You saw where she came from. You saw why she was precious of this story, and I liked it. I mean, I don't know. Nothing made me sort of roll my eyes and go, ugh, that's stupid, or why is that in there? I just, I actually really liked it. I liked it enough that I'd recommend it to friends. So,
oh, okay.
Well, guys, that works.
That's good.
we can compromise and say the fact that it seemed a little slow was kind of like your...
Okay.
You know, if you got to say one thing bad about it.
That would be the one thing I'd say bad about it. But, I mean... I suspect that's more just the style of story it was, and it's never not going to be slow.
Yeah, well, I think they had to build a lot, so I mean, they put a lot of layer on top of layer, and it takes time
exactly.
to do that.
It just takes time. You can't build. I don't know. I mean, it was always going to be a slow film. It was just the nature of the story that was being told, and.
Right.
Yeah, so I didn't like that because I don't generally like slow films, but still, I enjoy the film. So
okay,
yeah, that works.
Well, I did have like a slight one, and it, like I said kind of earlier, some of that slow build, they did it a little bit heavy-handedly, little ham-fisted at times. I thought, really, the culmination of that was in the kind of like portrayal of Colin Farrell's drunk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought it was a very it got to one point where he was, you know, kind of doing the coughing thing and this taking a big swig, and it felt very, you know, 1920s. What does a drunk look like, you know? And it just
dramas,
or church drama.
No one can
see,
just like
see he's a drunk. Pay attention.
Yeah.
You must understand.
People who drink alcohol don't just drink a little bit of alcohol. Sometimes they
just take a big swig and then they stagger around and then they. And that felt like directing to me versus Colin, because Colin Farrell was really good otherwise. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know. It just kind of felt a little, okay, we got it. So, but other than that, I agree with you, Jason. I thought it was a great film, and there wasn't really too many moments. I was really kind of sucked into the story the whole time, so.
Well, my moment, I guess, if it's a true story, or, you know, it's based on a true story, it seems hard to make this my moment, but I was just a little bit miffed that the Disney didn't invite her I was like, you signed up for this.
Yeah.
And now you're afraid that she's going to talk to the media and stuff. Like, that's your thing. Because it took away a lot of the credence that I'd given Disney from being, like what we talked about earlier with him being able to really cultivate and nurture artists, understand where they're coming from and really give them encouragement. Mm-hmm. And then to basically turn around and not invite her to her work kind of struck me as like, oh, so it was about the money. You know, yeah. Or, you know, it was about just getting it from her, not necessarily... like showing it to her and giving that truly what he exclaimed as redemption,
right.
You know, like that would require her to be there and, right. You know, kind of see it as well.
Well, it's, Disney was
I didn't mind that bit, actually. I thought, sorry, if I can jump in.
No, go ahead.
I didn't mind that bit because I thought it sort of, it made Disney a bit realer, which is, I mean, he really is. He wanted to create this magical, beautiful thing from her story.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just but he was a realist about it, and he thought she's probably going to be a pain in the ass if she turns up at the at the premiere, and she's gonna sour it, and that wouldn't be well. That would sort of defeat the whole purpose of doing it, and it would also he wouldn't be keeping his promise if she turned up and effectively destroyed the film, by her presence there.
And he says,
it's a bit of a jerk move too, but I like. I get it.
Yeah. Oh, I got it too.
Yeah, it made sense. Yeah. But
I mean, cause he said I have to protect the picture, which I think is what he was ultimately worried about, because he understood how media worked versus her. Because I mean, you know, Disney was a very dual type personality, where he was very much an Imaginarium, very much a, you know, cultivator of art, and wanted to see people redeemed, like, you know, like you saw that in the movie. But then he was also a businessman. He was a very good businessman, yeah. And he knew cold-heartedly how business worked. So
cold-blooded.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. That's not my come-on moment anymore. That completely is fine. Well, okay. So,
no,
I
thought it was real. I thought it was a realistic portrayal. That was all. Like,
yeah. I mean, like you said, if I had to have one, because I kind of feel like you guys have both said, you know, I really enjoy the movie. I didn't find a lot of faults with it.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like my favorite movie of the year or anything, but I was like, for the story it was telling, you know, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So favorite moment.
Now, in fairness, I would note my favorite movie of the year is going to be a comic book one or something like that. So,
no, I,
you know.
I think...
I'm a man of simple tastes.
Okay.
Nothing wrong with that. I can possibly agree with that, but... What?
Not yet.
Sorry,
not
you were going to say
it? Nope. I'm not going to say it, because that'll get us too far off on a tangent.
Okay.
I'm going to put my... Oh. I'm probably going to do my top 13, probably next week. And I was just trying to figure out where the closest comic book movie was to the top. And I realized that could be a conversation. And now I'm talking about it anyway.
Yeah, there we go.
Stop. All right. Control yourself.
Favorite moment.
All right. What was your favorite moment, Jason?
Oh,
Nothing?
I don't know. Oh, it's hard to pick, isn't it? I really like that just really brief scene where they tuck supercalifragilistic behind the behind the rest of it. I mean, I just thought that was such a hilarious scene.
No, it said
I just,
so
I
much.
Just, it was great. It's sort of everything was there, and you know, she's sitting there going, "Oh, this is, you can't make words up," and they've just got the most ridiculous word ever. And they're hiding. I just thought it was a great scene. But yeah. I also liked when Disney was, you know, selling her on. He got why she couldn't let it go, and why she could trust him to understand that. I like that too. So, lots of scenes for different reasons, I guess. But
Yeah, mine I kind of mentioned earlier was the scene with, you know, the Richard Sherman on the piano, just in the dark, you know, singing, I guess, Feed the Birds. And then, you know, Disney kind of comes in and says, that'll work. You know, it's just a really nice scene that I really enjoyed, partly because I'm a musician too, and, you know, enjoy music for what it is. And then just the speech about redemption and, you know, that was really just well done, I thought. You know, it's very kind of comedic at first and kind of summed up the whole feel of the film, and just a really, really great scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and also, I will mention the scene with Ralph, the driver, and her out there making that little lake or river in the
yes.
grass, mm-hmm. where he tells her, you know, for the first time about his kid and everything. That was really good. Great scene.
Well, yeah, I was going to say my favorite moment wasn't necessarily a moment, But it was basically, you know, Ralph or Paul Giamatti's character.
Yeah, yeah.
In general, because I thought he was an excellent bridge between me and the story.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, but I really often just dislike overtly like cheery characters
mm-hmm.
in movies, but for some reason, like, I mean, I guess it wasn't because I felt like he was cheery.
Yeah.
I felt like he was just like, hey, I mean, I got to be positive because, you know.
He had a positive view of the world.
That's my job.
Well, I mean, because he was doing it. Well, that's what I thought at first. But then when he gave the spiel about his daughter and was like, you know, I could have a crappy day every day or, you know, I could. You know, someone like that could really look on the crap side of life. But he was always looking on the bright side of life.
Yeah, well, I mean, the film justified him having a cheery nature and said he has a cheery nature despite this. And I think justifying a character with a cheery nature makes it avoid what you're saying when you don't like just a generally cheery person. Mm-hmm. They don't really explain it. So the fact they explain it, he's cheery anyway. And that whole scene where she's leaving on the airplane for the first time and she gives him that list of, you know, here, read this. And this is Albert Einstein and Frida Kahlo. And he's mm-hmm. like, what is this list for? She's like, all people with disabilities. She says, your daughter, she can do anything. And then she says, turn it over. And it's Walt Disney. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's just a fantastic scene. Yeah.
Mm.
Does that do it?
I think that does it. Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, we by no means covered every single thing, but I think we hit on enough at least, you know, get the conversation started.
Oh, yeah.
So from here, this is where I thank my guests for being here by allowing them to promote whatever they'd like to promote, because as you can tell, they've got lots of smart things to say, and you should probably want to interact with them outside of this.
That's right.
So, Jason, since you are part of the, since I've had the pleasure of having you on because of this group that we're a part of, you know, just tell us about what you're doing and how people can either follow you, get in contact with you, or see the work that you're doing.
Okay, I host two podcasts. The one that I'm involved with here is called The Sci-Fi Show, and that's Fi with a PH, so SciPhiShow.com. That's the website, and it's science fiction and philosophy. So the show normally consists of me doing a monologue about some piece of science fiction and some of the ideas found in it. So if it sounds like the sort of thing you might find interesting, come and have a look, come and have a listen, shoot me some feedback and let me know what you think. And the other show I host is a podcast called Christian Meets World at christianmeetsworld.com. Which is me blathering on about whatever I think is interesting. Politics, social issues, philosophy, ethics, apologetics, whatever takes my fancy. That's the Sci-Fi Show is scripted each week. Christian Meets World, much less so. I've been doing the Sci-Fi Show, well, actually on and off, for about 4 or 5 years now. I did it for a while and then stopped for a while and then I've sort of come back to it. I'm up to about episode 24 of the new run of it at the moment. So, yeah, check it out if it sounds like something you'd enjoy. Yeah, and check out Christian Meets World if you like to. It's a lot less consistent, but it's fun.
Do you have, like, a Twitter or anything that people could follow you?
You can find... I have a Twitter account, The Sci-Fi Show. I don't really use it much apart from mentioning that episodes have come out these days. Mostly, if you want to look for me, look for The Sci-Fi Show or Christian Meets World on Facebook. I just do a search for them, you'll find them. Okay. It's facebook.com/Christian Meets World and /Sci-Fi Show. So that's probably the easiest place to find me, or just email me, listen to the show, or go to the website. You'll find all the links to where you want to go from there.
All right.
So that works.
That's what I do. Yeah.
All right.
Well, for me, I feel like at this point, having been on the show a lot, I feel like everybody kind of knows if you've listened to the show before. I feel like I should start a blog just to have it so that I can tell it on the show. but I'm a writer, so I primarily do a lot of stuff behind the scenes, of course. But I do have some short films, and we always link them at the show notes. I am on Twitter at Mark Wingdinger, so just a funny version of my name. That's pretty much it for me. You can find me on Facebook too if you like.
Except for the most important thing.
Oh, we do a football podcast.
No, that's not the most important thing. Not anymore.
What is my most important thing?
That you are now officially a contributor to the Real World Biology blog.
I do write on this blog a lot, so I figured that was a given though. It's this show.
I'm just mentioning it.
Yeah, you know. Yeah.
You have your own contributor page and everything.
Yes, and I'll say that for the record right now. I'm starting a new section, a recurring section for Real World called Review, where I watch movies that I've seen before and just comment on them, and hopefully other people will contribute to that as well. But something coming in the future. I will not say when, though.
Because I'll believe it when I see it. But, like I said, one of the main things that I wanted to continue to mention is that this podcast is airing during the Christian Geek podcast crossover event. So all the podcasts that are participating in the event are going to be linked in the show notes. You'll be able to find, you know, like I said, not every show is for everyone, but there's lots of great stuff there. I listen to a number of those podcasts myself. Some of them are similar. Some of them kind of take a completely different, you know, look at things, but they're all really high quality. And like I said, some really good people behind them. So, but if you want to interact with me or let me know of movies you'd love to hear us discuss on the show, then feel free to follow me on the Real World Theology Twitter at Real World Theo, or follow me personally at Physification. You can also find us at our blog, realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And if you do find us on iTunes, review the show, bump our rankings, and let's get more people involved in the conversation. Like Jason.
Indeed.
That way we can keep things fresh. But again, I just wanted to thank my guests for being here. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Jason. Especially Jason, who is in the future, calling back to us.
Yeah, that's right.
And you, the listeners, for taking time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
See ya.